Please set your system clock to 1992 and join us on today's multimedia hyperguide tour of Windows 3.1. Hello again, folks. It's so wonderful to be back with you again on this Sunday. I'm your host, Super VGA, and in today's episode, I'm going to introduce you to the classic Windows MPC pack-in, San Diego Zoo Presents The Animals. So, you're probably going to be a little annoyed with me. Last week, I promised that I was going to be covering Indiana Jones and his desktop adventures. That's what I had promised at the end of the episode. But I had a bit of a change of heart for two reasons, actually. A bunch of reasons. One was I didn't actually get to finish the game yet, and that meant that I wasn't comfortable talking about it until I've actually completed at least a few different quests. I've, you know, in the past completed individual little quests in the game. But this time I wanted to give it a serious run through to see how far I could get. The other reason was just completely incidental. I went and saw the new documentary on Mr. Rogers. That's Fred Rogers, the host of I think the show was just called Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, or to be honest, I never actually grew up with Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. I knew it was on TV, but due to where I lived in a rural area, we didn't have cable TV, which meant that we didn't pick up American networks like PBS. So in Canada, we grew up with a different figure. Mr. Dress-Up was one of them. Another one was Fred Penner. But I wanted to see this Mr. Rogers documentary just because I thought he offered such a unique view of childhood through his show. And I was very, very surprised at how touching the documentary was, especially in how he understood what a child is and how to speak with children, how to react to children, and how to treat children as basically little people with big feelings. And so that was one thing that kind of got at me. And the other thing was, and maybe this is because of it, my wife and I made a little trip to the zoo today. We spent the afternoon at the zoo, and as part of my trip there, it brought back some old nostalgic feelings for the software title I'm going to talk about today. So apologies to those who were expecting to listen to a podcast on Indiana Jones, but I promise I will get to it in one of the next couple of episodes. But I thought I would make this a little bit special and more closer to my heart, talking about what zoos mean to kids, and especially what a zoo, a virtual zoo, meant to me as a 12-year-old child. So before we get to that, I got a wonderful email from friend of the podcast, Brian. Brian writes, "Hi, VGA, great podcast." Well, thank you very much, Brian. "I enjoyed your story about magazines and not being able to view the bundled CD-ROMs. I thought I'd write to you about a related topic, a program called Blender. I took a look at this old CD and saw a copyright date of 1996, so I must have used this product with Windows 95, but it is a Windows 3.1 compatible program, so perhaps you'll forgive my transgression." Don't worry, Brian, I'm not a stickler about dates or about operating systems here. I just love to hear from you. So he continues, "Blender was the first fully CD-ROM-based magazine. It covered pop culture matters such as TV, music, and movies. It was very much a product of its time, with a kind of grungy 90s aesthetic and edgy humor. The writing was quite good and the articles were well researched, but the magazine's most interesting feature was its format. Text was often interactive, with hypertext links showing box outs of supplementary information, audio snippets of albums, and video clips showing interviews and movie trailers. Each page of text had a backing soundtrack." Oh, there's some email coming in. Each page of text had a backing soundtrack, usually four bars of some contemporary pop song that distractingly looped over and over, and flipping to the next page would play another four bars from somewhere else in the song. The issue I owned, and by the way, I only ever bought one because it was about $20, had a great virtual tour of the Beastie Boys recording studio replete with QuickTime VR 360 degree scrollable images similar to Google Street View. It also featured the hard-hitting topic, What It Takes to Be Alternative in 1996, where they showed contrasting photos of celebrities and common household objects before and after getting a grungy Photoshopped makeover. The content was interesting, even about people and topics I didn't care about, because the format was so much fun. I clicked every link in this magazine, including those old-school DVD menu-style hidden buttons, which showed trippy animations and other silly things. This past year, I downloaded a bunch of issues from the wonderful archive.org and had a great time running through them on my Windows 98 VM virtual machine. There's no convenient list on that website, but here's a link to a search that will get you started. Bleepily yours, your friend Brian, the MIDI mapper. Well, thank you so much, Brian. I took a look through archive.org at Blender, and I remember it being on the shelves. I recognized it because it was in the same rack as CD-ROM Today and a couple of other kind of multimedia-heavy magazines that were out at that point. I never did buy a copy myself, maybe because CD-ROM Today, although trust me, this was the least grungy a publication at the time, it did often feature a lot of music from bands. I seem to remember interactive music was becoming a big thing at the time. I'm thinking of, if anybody remembers this, the idea of a multimedia interactive CD-ROM / music CD. I remember two at the time. One of them that comes to mind was a band called I Mother Earth, a Canadian band, who put out an album called Scenery and Fish. And the audio CD would play regularly in your car stereo. However, for those of us who had a car stereo with a CD player built in, mine did not. We had one plugged in via the cigarette lighter and a cassette tape adapter, and that was to my portable Sony Discman. But if you stuck it into a computer, it actually, and this is quite amazing for its time, worked on both Windows and Mac and gave you a little multimedia kind of experience. Maybe I'll do a future episode on this at some point. But anyway, to make a long story short, Brian, I have some very fond memories of those kind of music virtual tours. I thought they were wonderful. And you mentioned QuickTime VR. That's a huge topic of its own. I seem to remember watching a video of the 14 or 16-year-old kid who created or was involved in creating some aspect of the QuickTime library. He kind of became this overnight millionaire working for Apple. I want to find that. I think that was a 60 Minutes documentary that I had watched as a kid, and I was quite fascinated by the idea of this young teenage boy becoming an overnight sensation. For some reason, I think he was one of the designers or was involved in QuickTime VR. I could be completely wrong about this, so somebody please write in if I'm completely off. I'll try to do my research after the show and see and report back to you if just how foggy my memory was on that little tidbit. So anyway, Brian, thank you so much. I'm going to provide a link to your archive.org search for Blender magazine, and I'm hoping that at some point, Brian, you might be willing to appear on the show as a guest. I'd love to talk to you about Blender or any other topic you might find interesting. All right, so very quickly, I thought we could move on to the inventory check. I haven't done this in a little while. This is where I dig through what's come in the mail and dropped off parcels recently. I really shouldn't be buying any new, and this is, I just scare quoted that, new software. But I can't help myself. So the most recent purchase was a copy of Microsoft Windows for Workgroups. This is the OEM sealed edition. All I can do is kind of crinkle the box for you. It's not even a box, actually. It's just the user's guide and the diskettes and a certificate of authenticity wrapped up in shrink wrap. This would be the kind of thing that OEM distributors would have put out with their computers. I believe when I sold Gateway 2000 computers when I was a teenager, we used this very copy of Windows for Workgroups. I almost guarantee that almost none of our purchasers ever actually opened the shrink wrap on these because Windows came pre-installed. So you'd have very few reasons to bust out the old install disks. So I'm going to install this from scratch. A copy of Windows for Workgroups is really, really helpful for me because I want to set up my 486. This would be the Packard Bell Legend I still own. I want to set it up for networking. I would really be happy if I could transfer files from my Mac to my Packard Bell Legend here. Right now it can't. I don't have an ISA network card. All of my network cards are unfortunately PCI. So that's going to be a future job. I can't wait to crack the shrink wrap on this. And in fact, maybe I'm going to do, I had a user, a listener write in asking at some point if I was going to explain to people how to install Windows 3.1 on either DOSBox or on a new PC. I thought that was a wonderful suggestion. In fact, I remember this now. This was a Redditor who suggested that. So yeah, future episode. I would love to install this and walk you through it. So moving very quickly on to our main topic, what I found so interesting about San Diego Zoo Presents the Animals, which is unfortunately a very very long title for a very simple idea, it was a bundled piece of multimedia software that came with multimedia PCs, otherwise known as MPCs. MPC was a standard. It was a hardware standard Microsoft created in order to kind of help publicize that multimedia was becoming, or should be becoming, a big thing on computers of the early 1990s. And this kind of set some basic standards for consumers so they could walk into any shop and say, I want MPC level 1, MPC level 2, or MPC level 3. And it would tell you that your system met some basic minimum system requirements, that you'd have some kind of sound card that could produce sound at a certain frequency, that seems like the wrong word, at a certain, I'm losing my perspicacity here, at a sound card of a certain quality, so 16-bit versus 8-bit, 44 kilohertz versus 22 kilohertz, that kind of thing, that your display adapter and monitor could manage a minimum color depth and a minimum resolution, a certain hard drive size, a certain amount of RAM, a CD-ROM that has a specified minimum transfer speed of data, as well as seek time, and of course that this was, and again, this is because it was a Microsoft standard, that it was Windows 3.0, and this would be Windows 3.0 with the multimedia extensions that came out later, and Windows 3.1 compatibility. The reason for this, it's funny, my cat seems to know every time I'm podcasting, he comes by to say hi. He just got his brief little hug and he's ready to go again. For people like my family, my father and my mother, the problem was always in choosing the right computer. You know, this idea of, this computer is going to last me a good 10 or 20 years, right? That was always my dad's attitude towards them. Excuse me, I just realized I drank water on the air. I couldn't be the first person who's done this. So my folks wanted a very quick rule of thumb way of buying things, and I'm sure this was typical for many parents at the time because this was the early 1990s. In the 1980s, if you were going to buy a computer, you kind of had to go to a mom and pop style computer hardware shop. Otherwise known as the local computer shop or just the computer store. These were places run by hardcore nerds who would often build these machines from scratch. It was not very common then in the 1980s to buy a fully pre-built mass market machine. You know, there were some out there, of course. There was Compaq, and there was IBM, True Blue IBM machines, but this wasn't quite the big deal as this was, as this became in the 1990s. In the 90s, my family would want to go to a mass market shop like Best Buy or Future Shop, and they would want to come home with a brand they recognized, like a Packard Bell, an IBM, or a Compaq. Because they didn't know what hardware they needed. Nobody knew the difference. Nobody of my parents' generation, I shouldn't say nobody, but very few people of my parents' generation knew the difference between a 286, 386, God help them, a 486 SX versus the DX. And they wanted an easy way of glancing at a price sheet and knowing, is this going to last my family for a few years? Will my kids grow into it like a, like I mentioned, like an oversized pair of shoes? And is this affordable and within our price range? So Microsoft designed, when I was a kid, only two levels, one and two existed. Level three was soon to follow. Level one was a 386 SX16. So that's a 16 megahertz SX386. 2 megs of RAM minimum, a 30 meg hard drive, a VGA adapter capable of 640 by 480 at 256 colors, a single-speed CD-ROM, and a Sound Blaster compatible sound card that was capable of 22 kilohertz and 8-bit sound, and it also had to support input at 11 kilohertz. And of course, it had to be compatible with Windows 3.0 with the multimedia extensions. Now, our computer was a little bit faster than that. It was actually a level 2, meaning that it was a 486, and these are the minimum requirements, remember, a 486 SX25 CPU. That is, again, an SX, if for anybody not familiar, is Intel's kind of nerfed for form of the 486 DX, which was the 486 capable of floating point instructions. The SX did not have the floating point instructions enabled. So again, I use the word nerfed because this was basically a DX with a bunch of lines cut on it. It had 4 megs of RAM. The minimum requirement was 4 megs of RAM, 160 meg hard drive, a 16-bit color Super VGA adapter capable of 640 by 480, a double-speed CD-ROM, and a sound card, Sound Blaster compatible, at 44.1 kHz and 16 bits. Now, this is really interesting because as I read off of these requirements, our computer, our IBM PS1, met those basic system requirements almost exactly. It had 4 megs of RAM. I've got the hard drive here. I can tell you, let me pull this out again for the 50th time I've looked at it this month. The hard drive is, it's a 256 megabyte hard drive. So I almost doubled the the minimum system requirements there. It did have a 1 meg 16-bit color Super VGA adapter capable of 640 by 480. I did have a double-speed CD-ROM, which I believe was an MKE, and it had a Sound Blaster 16, which supported 44.1 and 16-bit sound. And for the processor, we had a 486 SX33. So in some ways, we actually exceeded the system requirements by a little bit. I'm actually staring at the RAM here because I remember we had 4 megs of RAM, and at the time, that didn't give us a lot of future-proofing. 8 meg video games, computer games were on the horizon, and within a year, I would be regretting having a machine with 4 megs of RAM. So, all this to say, San Diego Zoo's game, The Animals, was bundled with MPC-compatible computers. It had already been in as a pack-in for 2 years. There was a DOS version of this, actually, that had come out 2 years earlier from the software Toolworks. And I even noticed that the Sega CD had, or Mega CD if you are in Europe, had a version of The Animals too. I found this mind-blowing that there was actually, this was ported to so many different systems. There was a version for the 3DO also, I'm assuming with slightly higher video quality than you saw in the Sega CD or the DOS version. Now, this is where I had to cheat a little bit. Our computer, when we bought it, came with the MS-DOS version of The Animals. The version I'm presenting you today is the Windows 3.1 version, which is different. I find that very fascinating. They did go through a lot of effort to redo the UI to suit a nice Windows 3.1 interface, and I think it's a very impressive interface, but I'll get to that. So what is San Diego Zoo Presents The Animals? Well, really, it's more of an encyclopedia than it is an edutainment game. Edutainment games being games specifically targeted at kids and also that have a lot of playful mini game mechanics in them. This isn't like that. This is more of an encyclopedia that you would browse through and enjoy the information for informational purposes. It had a somewhat, I noticed, a political, ecological theme about preserving the environment, which was, let's say, very typical of the early 1990s. I remember environmentalism being a major topic. When I was a kid a couple of years earlier, I believe I even did one of my science fair projects on the greenhouse effect, because the greenhouse effect had been basically in every Time magazine issue for several years by that point. So the encyclopedia itself features, as they advertise this, over 200 animals that span 80 full motion videos and 1300 color photographs. I think I also read that it has 2.5 hours of CD quality audio. Now, let's be a little honest about this. when they said CD quality audio in, it looks like my cat came back for round two of petting and hugs. When they said CD quality audio in 1992, that probably meant audio in, let's say, the 22 kilohertz 16-bit range. No one today would accept that as CD quality. CD quality today being defined, I would say, pretty commonly as 44.1 kilohertz at 16-bit. So, yeah, a little bit of a stretch there. But I can honestly say that the audio quality is very, very good for the audio portions of the... Wow, my cat is not too happy with me. Thanks for the interruption, my boy. The audio is refreshingly crisp for the most part, and I'll talk about this a little bit in the design, but whoever designed this, and I should say, shouldn't say whomever, but the actual designers of the audio experience by Arnowitz Studios, and we'll talk about that a little bit later on, put a lot of attention into making this a more immersive experience. And that's something that you wouldn't see typically on encyclopedia CD-ROMs. They weren't really meant to be immersive experiences. They were meant to be more purely informational. And I can say that this multimedia program really made an effort at pulling off a very good user experience. So let's talk a little bit about the design. I'd say it was fairly intuitive. The main menu is actually an isometric reimagining of the San Diego Zoo's 10 different biomes. The artists have chosen to paint it in a watercolor wash, which was then later digitized in a 256 color palette. I'm really amazed at how colorful it is. The artists really went out of their way to use dithering effects. I'm assuming that this was probably done in Photoshop. They used a point dithering effect to give the UI an almost pointillist style. And when you take a look at the UI for the main menu, many of you are probably going to recognize a very 1990s style of painting and graphic design. It's touching in its own way. What I like about it is that the main menu is supposed to make you feel like you're getting a virtual tour of the zoo. You're kind of at a zoomed out overhead view of the zoo from up top. And what it allows you to do is click on one of the 10 biomes and it takes you to that biome. On the right side panel, you get a little photograph of the biome, whatever it's going to be, let's say the rainforest biome. And then there's a left panel, which is all text. And the text tells you a little bit more information about that biome, usually 2 to 3 pages, let's say under 250 words worth of information for each biome. Underneath the photograph, you can actually click on several icons. Some of them are other photos of the biome, some of them are sounds, and some of them are video. And video is, let's say, it's both the best and the worst aspect of this experience. The video, and I want to talk about this a little bit later on the technical section. The video, while the production is of very, very high quality, it's the kind of thing you would have saw on promotional television spots for San Diego Zoo. The encoding, unfortunately, is a little on the rough side. So not only do you get kind of a choppy frame rate, but also I noticed that the audio clicks and pops a lot, unfortunately, just due to the way the audio was encoded on the video. But we'll get to that. One thing that really struck me about San Diego Zoo is this is both targeted at both adults and kids. Some of the videos are very, very playful, directly written for kids. Other videos are, let's say, a little bit more on the informational side, and you could have easily sat down with your, let's say, 5 to 15-year-old, well, maybe not a 15-year-old, 5 to 10-year-old kid, and enjoy this clicking through the zoo together. Now, I didn't really actually tell you much about why this game mattered to me. Usually I give you the story first, and this time I just forgot. At that age, I had actually never been to a zoo in my life. And so I certainly knew what zoos were, and I knew the entire, you know, theory behind them. But for me growing up, especially growing up where I did in rural areas, animals were a thing that you saw face to face every day. And it was a little strange to me to go to see animals in an urban environment where they were caged in. So this was a very new experience to me. And what actually gripped me the most about San Diego Zoo was not the animals themselves. My sister and I certainly loved the idea of exploring our way through the zoo. But what was more important to me was the fact that this was playing interactive video. You could watch full motion video on my computer. It was the most amazing experience. And I spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to make those little postage stamp videos play full screen. Again, I'll talk about that in a few minutes. But what I really loved was at some point, my sister and I figured out that the audio and the video actually were in just user accessible folders on the disk. So if you went into the movies folder, even though they were not named in very descriptive names, you could watch the videos outside of the actual application. That blew my mind. I was so used to being locked out of the data. I mean, you have to remember that DOS games in general, you'd either have a file which was a kind of compressed a large collection or archive of data that you couldn't touch. The idea that I could actually load up WAV files and play them back whenever I wanted to, or change the system sounds to play back the WAV files found on the CD-ROM, blew us away. So you have to remember that for kids, you know, the experience sometimes isn't always in the application itself. Sometimes it's fun to take the box off of the, take the television box out and play with the box itself instead of the television. So San Diego Zoo certainly had that going for my sister and I. Back to the design of the program, one thing I'm very struck by now, and this is, you know, again, a very impressive design considering this is 1993-94, the user interface is made to be a little bit of a hunting game, a little bit of an Easter egg hunting game. I'm impressed that you can click your way through the biomes, that there always seems to be some piece of information that you haven't seen yet, no matter how many times you've used the program. That to me is the feature of fairly good educational game, or in this case, more of an encyclopedia. Now, switching over to the development history, unfortunately, I couldn't find that much of a story to explore here. The game was developed by a company called Arnowitz Studios. Arnowitz Studios was fairly well known at the time for designing educational titles on CD-ROM. They were purportedly the first company to ever have a bestseller multimedia CD-ROM. They set the record for that at 6 million copies. Now, I suspect this number may be fudged a little bit because I doubt those are all retail copies. I suspect more than half of that, or 3/4 to 2/3 of that, were bundled in with multimedia PCs that Microsoft was trying to push at the time. That was certainly true of my family. This is also probably the fact that The Animals was distributed on several different formats. So from what I could see, the Sega CD, the Panasonic 3DO, Windows 3.1, a DOS version, and a Macintosh version. So let's say that it may be more sold like 1 million copies of each of those. But anyway, it's ridiculously impressive that this company pulled it off. Arnowitz Studios went on to become an Emmy Award-winning multimedia company that's based out of Sausalito, California. As I said before, unfortunately, there wasn't much information to dig up on the back history of Arnowitz Studios. They eventually left the educational market and multimedia market and now are focused on kind of, as I actually think it's one man, the original founder and CEO of Arnowitz. He went on to become, let's say, a little bit of a horse whisperer for corporate culture and cultural change within corporations. So I apologize. I wish I could have a little bit more for you there, but it just isn't there. So where to get it? Well, thankfully, somebody has archived their original Packard Bell CD-ROM version of it on archive.org. I will put a link to that in the show notes. You are very, very welcome to try it out on the Internet Archive. So just a little bit on the technical aspects of San Diego Zoo. One thing I wanted to dig into a little bit is the video compression. So the videos on the CD are encoded with MSVC, otherwise known as Microsoft Video 1 compression and decompression library. They are compressed to 160 by 120 videos with 8-bit or 256 color depth. And they're recorded and played back at 15 frames per second. The audio is mono at 11 kilohertz and 8 bits. Now, a few things come out of these choices. One of them is that the Microsoft Video 1 video compression and decompression algorithm, the MSVC codec, was a very, very early codec that was released as the kind of primary codec for Microsoft Video for Windows. This is the video for Windows that's used in Windows 3.1 and 3.0 with multimedia extensions. Now, from what I can understand, Video 1 was actually using something called a vector quantization codec that Microsoft had licensed from another codec manufacturer called MediaVision. MediaVision, I'm sure many of you will know, is the company that had the Pro Audio Spectrum, a nice sound card for the ISA architecture. Now, back to Video 1. Video 1 used a compression algorithm that split each frame into 4x4 pixel blocks. So without going into too much of the technical detail, what ended up happening was that you would actually have visually less color data and less resolution using this algorithm than you would having a competing algorithm at exactly the same video resolution. And this created blockiness, also graininess too, and in general, the video quality is not great. Another big problem with this is actually more the audio quality. It's recorded at, as I said earlier, 11 kilohertz and 8-bit sound. What ends up happening is, I think due to the codec used or perhaps the person who's mastering it, there's a lot of very bad clipping. So anytime that there's a lot of heavy use of bass, the bass is clipped and you hear this kind of pop in the audio playback. And I noticed that that's completely restricted to the videos. The regular audio portions of the CD-ROM sound just fantastic. But as soon as you play back a video, you hear a lot of clicking and popping. So that was unfortunate. But again, this is likely a product of the fact that this is a very, very early use of video playback. And I can tell you this much, it is not much better if you look at the video playback that, digitized videos that came with CD-ROM today, who used, again, the same, they did not use the same compression algorithm, but they used a similar algorithm that produced a lot of lossiness. Now, there is one advantage I noticed. Video 1 does not use the type of dithering effects that I can see in other codecs. And so you do get a fairly clean image, although it looks very blocky. I would say Video 1 tends to look a little bit more like MPEG quality video. Well, that's it for another episode of the show. I'm so glad you took the time to sit in with us today. Next week, I think I'm going to return back to Indiana Jones and his desktop adventures. In the meantime, feel free to write in about anything. I've been suggesting writing in about future episodes or memories you have about current episodes, but I'd love to hear from you about anything Windows 3.1 related that you thought was important. For anybody who's kind of waiting for me to get to the good stuff, one of the big upcoming episodes I have is going to be on the use of modems at the terminal and potentially Trumpet Windsock, the TCP/IP stack. Those will probably be separate episodes just because they're big topics on their own, but I'm really looking forward to it. So if you have a memory of using dial-up on your Windows 3.1 machine to using either the terminal or if you dialed up to services like CompuServe and Prodigy, I'd love to hear back from you. So again, this is Super VGA signing off for the week. I hope you have a wonderful week. See you next Sunday. Finally, a personal note to listeners. When I recorded the first episode of this podcast way back in 2018, I was starting to write a book about growing up with computers of the 80s and 90s, modems, bulletin board systems, and even the early internet. It took several years to write it all down, but I managed to weave together over 80 of those stories, many of which I allude to in this podcast, into a novel-length book. It's called Mages and Modems, A Childhood Well Wasted in the Golden Age of Personal Computers, Games, and Internet Piracy. The stories are heartwarming, funny, and honestly, sometimes a little embarrassing. I don't ask for donations to keep this podcast running, so if you'd like to support me and see new episodes of the podcast, please head on over to my website at tomotama.com/books. That's tomotama.com/books, and order a copy of Mages and Modems. There you'll find a DRM-free ebook edition and a beautifully printed paperback edition that I actually designed myself. I hope the stories bring back for you some of the warm memories of the DOS, Windows, and Macintosh era that we all love.